Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. This is a special episode analysing the Chancellor's spring statement with Paul Johnson from the IFS. Now, you may remember Paul was on last year, and he is the best person for explaining what budgets and spring statements mean, because he cuts through all the politics, gives it to you straight in very clear terms. And this is a fantastic impartial analysis of what Rishi Sunak's statement this week means, what the effect of it will be, some of the economic realities, and not just tied to the statement, but over the last few years and looking ahead in the medium term and what the effect of all this will be, and just the realities of dealing with inflation and what the Bank of England can do. This is just a phenomenal. This is like having a really good, I'm sure I said this last time, but it is like having a great economics tutor where you can just ask them anything and they tell you it in a style in which you completely understand. This is a phenomenal education on the state of our public finances, the political and economic choices that Rishi Sunak has made since becoming Chancellor, whether he's been consistent or not, the reality of who's paying what and what the effect of that will be, and some great stuff on Labour's proposed windfall tax. This is just fantastic, just in general, because it's not just about the spring statement. It's about the economic realities facing us in the next 3 or 4 years, about our behaviour change and why that's impacting things. It's just phenomenal. I could always talk to Paul for hours and hours and hours, but he is a man much in demand, particularly on weeks like this. Don't forget, you can email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com, usually with stories of unusual encounters with politicians. I'm still getting tons of messages about the Neil Kinnock and Tom Tugendhat episodes, which Dan Jarvis got in touch. Now, if you haven't listened to the Tom Tugendhat episodes yet, then I won't give anything away. But Tom tells a story about Dan Jarvis. They both served in the armed forces. They both served in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Tom in the show the other week said that he'd seen Dan in a particular state. Dan Jarvis got in touch to say that he loved the episode. So we can only presume he did not deny the story, which, I won't spoil, but if you have heard it, you'll know what I mean. So we will take the fact that Dan Jarvis enjoyed it, we'll take it as Tom Tugendhat was absolutely telling the truth about what he saw. So there you go. And also, thank you to everyone who's come to see me on tour. Oh, man, this week has just been such a pleasure. You know what? After COVID, being out there on the road is such a treat. I get the train everywhere. It's a lovely way to travel, obviously. Not that I'm turning into Michael Portillo, but you're like, oh, man, this week I've been in Norwich, Maidstone, you know, the last few days, all over the place, in Alnwick and in the northeast, and then I'm up in Scotland next week. I think both Edinburgh dates have sold out, by the way, and I think there's only about 5 tickets left for Glasgow. So if you are planning to come and see me in Scotland, do get those tickets now at mattford.com. But anyway, I'm coming to Leicester as well soon. Enough of the self-promotion. This is a special episode with Paul Johnson from the IFS. And this is just from start to finish, the best briefing on the spring statement you will get, because it's not just about the tinkering around the edges. It puts it all in context in very clear language. Enjoy. Paul, first things first, this must be like being a nun at Easter for you. This must be the most in-demand period for the IFS.
Well, that's a simile I haven't come across before, like a nun at Easter. I can't think of too many similarities there. But yes, it's certainly budgets and spring statements are certainly the busiest couple of days of the year. They're actually great fun while they happen, but I'm quite pleased they only happen twice a year.
Yes, I mean, they must, obviously, it's a whole load of effort for the government, but you are the people that really everyone wants to talk to. You are the leading independent voice on well, fiscal studies. So you've been on every show, every podcast, every telly show, and thank you for coming on this one to go over the Chancellor's statement. First things first, just on the meat of the statement itself. Well, it's so hard sometimes for the public to pick through exactly what the main points are. What would you say is, if you had to sum it up in a headline, what is the main headline of this spring statement?
The spring statement specifically, I think the big headline is that the Chancellor is offsetting a bit of the big increase in national insurance contributions that was announced in the autumn, particularly for the lower paid, and he's made a big sort of pre-election gimmick, I would call it, in terms of a penny off the basic rate in 2024. I think the other headline is actually what he didn't do, which is that he didn't do anything for people on benefits. And I know you asked for one headline. The other thing I think is really important to do is to put this in the context of what he announced a year ago and what he announced in the autumn. It's important to see all of that in context, not just what he did on Wednesday this week in isolation.
Obviously, during a period of not just national but international strife, people's first thoughts are with the most vulnerable. He says, effectively, like you did there, that he'd already made his announcement on universal credit in a previous statement, and that still stands. Therefore, this statement wasn't going to focus on those people. Is he right that he's still helping people on benefits? I saw him say on Sky News yesterday that the low paid was his biggest priority. Taking all of his statements together as a package, could you draw that as a fair conclusion?
Well, he's certainly helping them. So he's done essentially three things. One is that he did make universal credit more generous for people in work back in October, and that's worth potentially £1,000 a year to quite a few of those people. That's quite significant, but only for those people in work. And the other thing he did, which he did just in February, which was give essentially £150 to everyone in council tax band D and below. So that's a flat rate across the distribution, and £200 off energy bills, but repayable, which again, flat across the distribution. So you put those together, and that's all of that is proportionally targeted at people on lower incomes, is worth quite a lot to people on benefits. But since February, we now expect inflation to be higher than we thought in February, particularly energy bills. And because benefits are only going to go up by 3.1% in April, and inflation is going to be probably averaging 8% over the year, but all of that together and people on welfare benefits will be worse off in 2022 than they were in 2021. And they're obviously the most vulnerable group. Now, there's a decision about priorities, about how much you might want to protect them and spend them on them and so on. But given that the main reason they're going to be worse off is actually a sort of almost an administrative oversight in the way that we increase benefits each year. In other words, we increased them in line with what inflation was in September. I don't really understand why he didn't just come back and say, well, this year we'll increase it in line with what we expect inflation to be in April. And then I think both he would have helped the most vulnerable and he would have avoided an awful lot of the very bad headlines that he's had over the last couple of days. So I'm slightly baffled by that one, if I'm absolutely honest.
Do you think that's the sort of thing he will correct in the coming days and weeks?
It would be odd if it would be an admission. The only way he could come back and do that would be to stand up and say, I made a mistake. Because, you know, we now know, or we now got a very good idea of what, you know, and have known for months what the impact of these energy price rises and inflation would be on this group. So he might come back, but I think if he does, he would have to come back fairly humbly and say, look, I made a mistake here. It would be quite hard to brazen through and say something has changed. And while it's the wrong choice, you know, at the end of March, it's the right choice at the end of April. I mean, there is one sort of practical administrative thing that he might bring to his defence, which is that bizarrely enough, other than universal credit, a lot of benefits, it does take months and months and months to make changes to them. So But there's another reason why delay is a bad idea, because you know, it may well be true that if he made the announcement now, you couldn't actually make the changes until late summer. But equally, if he doesn't make the announcement for another couple of months, it'll be even longer before you can actually make the changes.
Yeah, you may have another problem. You know, if you get inflation continuing at the rate it's at or getting higher, is that likely to have an impact on unemployment? And then you'll end up with more people, therefore, unemployed, on out-of-work benefits and falling behind?
That is almost the biggest question. And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, there are two ways that this could go in a sort of extreme sense. I mean, inflation could result in higher wages and sort of the economy overheating more generally, and then more inflation and the labour market getting tighter and tighter. Or it could result in unemployment because, you know, firms aren't able to put their prices up in line with the cost that they're facing, and people can't afford to buy the products that are being produced. And different people take different views on that. And which way it goes will matter really, really fundamentally for the direction of the economy over the next several years. I mean, what a lot of, you know, the danger is it does both those things. If you know, people are harking back a lot to the 1970s. I mean, it's very different now from the 1970s in all sorts of ways, not least that, you know, we don't have strong unionization across the workforce. But in the 1970s, in a sense, you got the worst of both worlds. You had inflation resulting in higher wages, resulting in more inflation and higher unemployment because some groups were, as it were, pricing themselves out of jobs, or British industry was becoming uncompetitive. And that's what people called stagflation, so unemployment and inflation going up. At the moment, we don't have any signs at all, actually, of unemployment going up. Unemployment is the dog that has, to an astonishing degree, just has not barked post-COVID. And isn't it interesting? A year ago when we spoke, we were talking about COVID and its impact on the economy. We're only 10 minutes in. We haven't even mentioned COVID. It's the biggest shock in hundreds of years. And already we're sort of thinking about other stuff.
But is that because the war in Ukraine has focused the mind elsewhere? Or there obviously still is an economic impact of COVID, of all that borrowing to pay for furlough, that the money has to come back. Just to decouple those two things, how much is this inflation to do with COVID?
In a global sense, quite a lot of it is to do with COVID, because even before Ukraine, inflation was on its way up to, you know, historically very high levels. And that was associated with problems in supply chains right across the world. Also associated, I think, with the huge amount of money that governments across the world pumped into economies through COVID. In the UK, you've got, I mean, lots of households are sitting on lots of money that they saved through the COVID period. We've seen what's been happening to the housing market, which still seems to be going pretty crazy, and that's associated with ultra low interest rates and some of the money that was saved through COVID. So the underlying, the thing about Ukraine is it's come on top of what was already really quite an inflationary environment. And that inflationary environment was created by the combination of the structural problems that globally that COVID created and the wall of money that governments threw at it.
And now on top of that, effectively fuel prices have driven up not just the price of fuel itself, but all the consequentials that impacts on transporting goods across borders, running, you know, heating for firms and all stuff like that are reflected in prices. Is it as simple as that, or am I over?
Yeah, I mean, that's broadly right. I mean, again, there was already an issue with fuel, with energy prices pre-Ukraine. I mean, that was one of the things that was driving the pre-Ukraine inflation. So again, it's bad news on top of bad news, in a sense. I mean, if the Ukraine situation had occurred, if COVID hadn't occurred and we were in the sort of situation we've been in, you know, 2020 and then Ukraine had occurred, we would not be talking about inflation at, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10% over the next couple of years. We would have been talking about a spike up, and we've been talking about worried about fuel prices, but we would not have been anywhere near as worried as we are, because it's sitting on top of what was already actually quite a serious situation in terms of energy prices and inflation more generally. So, you know, this has come at a, from an economic point of view, this has come at a very bad moment. I mean, much worse economically than if it had happened 3 years ago.
This is the first time since independence of the Bank of England that inflation has hit these heights. And we know that the governor of the Bank of England has to write to the Chancellor if inflation goes above or below quite a narrow band. Obviously, it's way above where it's meant to be. Traditionally, chancellors pre-independence might try and control inflation with interest rates. Obviously, interest rates have been very, very low for a very long time. Firstly, would it be right to try and correct this inflationary surge, given that it's global, by altering UK interest rates? And I guess connected to that, how much can the UK do about inflation on its own?
Yeah, really good questions. I mean, I think one thing is, I personally, I found it surprising throughout the second half of last year, the Bank of England didn't do more at that time, because it was obvious, seemed to me, that inflation was on a pretty upward path at that moment. But you're right, a lot of this inflation is, as you say, globally generated. So what's the point of the UK doing anything? Well, I mean, the point about increasing, if we do increase interest rates, then that, that will, that should increase the value of the currency, which would make imports cheaper. Is one route to impacting inflation, but it also might have a dampening impact on asset prices, and to some extent, if people don't feel their asset values going up so fast, they might be less willing to spend, and that might have a dampening effect on inflation. And if you've got a variable rate mortgage, you need to spend more on it if interest rates go up, though. Most mortgages are now fixed for a period of time, so the mechanism is a bit dulled. So it's definitely not a straightforward thing, and it's quite difficult for the bank, because they really don't have, their instruments are interest rates and quantitative easing, which have an effect looking two or three years or a year or two hence on price levels and inflation, but they're not immediate. I think the government also needs to sort of play a role here as well. I mean, if you look at what happened over the 2010s, is you had very tight fiscal policy, in other words, austerity, and very loose monetary policy. In other words, as you said, the historically incredibly low interest rates. I think in retrospect, we might have been better off with slightly higher interest rates and slightly looser fiscal policy. I think this time round, I think could do with some slightly higher interest rates.
So the Bank of England could do that, and that might have some sort of an effect and help things for UK inflation. Just thinking about the sort of medium term then, obviously people, I don't remember the 1970s, a lot of people who listen to this podcast do. I remember vaguely the 90s, and I certainly remember the Labour narrative about interest rates at 15%, inflation at 12%, houses getting repossessed, negative equity, all stuff like that. Even though we might not be at 70s levels, is there a fear that something that similar that happened in the 1990s might happen?
Well, again, we're a very long way from those kinds of interest rates. I mean, the interest rates were much, much higher in the early 90s, and indeed, I do remember that, and I made my very first house purchase, I think, when interest rates were really quite high.
Oh God!
We're actually where we are at the moment is the interest rates at less than 1%, inflation at something like 7 or 8%. That's probably, I mean, I haven't checked this, that could be the lowest real interest rate. In other words, once you take out inflation, in the entire history of the country. I haven't checked that, but it certainly feels plausible. And that makes borrowing incredibly cheap. You know, that I think is one of the reasons why, given all of the uncertainty that's around, house prices are still zipping on up, because they're actually probably the best hedge against inflation that you've got. And the borrowing is so cheap. So I think every sort of crisis is different. So this has some comparisons with the 1973-4 period and beyond in two respects. First, there was an oil price shock there, as there is an energy price shock here. And secondly, and this is not quite the same thing, but in the early 70s, there was a huge injection of cash into the economy to try and overcome that. It's become known as the Barber boom after the Conservative Chancellor at the time, Tony Barber, who just chucked huge amounts of money at the economy. And the Labour government then had to deal with massive inflation, which was partly stoked by their predecessors. And of course, we've got two of those things now. We had huge amounts of money thrown into the economy in very different circumstances to deal with COVID and this energy price rise. So there are some things similar there, but as I say, there are other things that are very different, and not least, as far as we've seen over the last 20 years, there's been very little of the same kind of relationship between inflation and wages, and between tight labour markets and wages that we got in the 1970s. And we are in a world of massively lower interest rates, of much more flexible labour markets, and so on. And then the sort of thing that I think it's actually less of a parallel with what was happening in the early 90s, where we had the we had the sort of response to a massive boom created by essentially large amounts of money pumped into the economy by Nigel Lawson at the end of the 1980s, and by the relationship between the UK exchange rate and the European exchange rate. And then we had the collapse after we fell out of the European exchange rate mechanism. So again, that had its specific elements. And I think we've got a different set of specific elements this time. And I think what one learns after what is far too long working on and thinking about these things is that you prepare for all of the previous crises, and then a completely different one comes along.
Well, that's it. I mean, I wonder, people always want big, bold answers and very clear government reaction. And I wonder sometimes if, in a situation like this where things are volatile, actually not always taking big action is the correct thing. Whether just letting it play out. If he thinks that actually this is a short-term inflationary shock, trying to sort of overcorrect will create medium and long-term problems, when the best option might be to actually do a little less.
I think there's some truth in what you're saying, but it's become politically harder and harder to do that, particularly given the huge amount of protection that we got through COVID. I think people have come to expect protection. Also, I think there clearly are some people who will struggle if something isn't done. I think that's why there's been so much focus on those on the very lowest incomes. But I also think there's the Chancellor has acknowledged correctly that we are all being made poorer by this, and the only choices he's got is about how to distribute the pain effectively. And he's chosen to distribute it in terms of his policies. I mean, he's very, very dramatically increasing taxes on higher earners, and he is providing some protection for lower earners on those and those on benefits. He's also cutting back on his spending plans relative to what he was intending. So I think his best defense of what he's doing is, in the short run, I'm doing some stuff to protect some groups on lower earnings. I'm, in the long run, I'm really taking some money from higher earners. I'm sharing this cost across people who are dependent on welfare, and people in work, and public services. And you're right, I can't do vastly more in the coming year, not least because I'm worried that if I pump
piles more into the economy yet again, that might stimulate even more inflation, or it might lead to the Bank of England really sticking interest rates up even quicker.
Okay, so that's really interesting, because it does feel as if there's a slight contradiction. You know, his debut a couple of years ago was, I'm going to pay everyone's wages for a year and a half, this incredible initial intervention from Rishi Sunak. And now he feels like a guy saying, oh, well, things are difficult, I can't do everything for everyone. It almost feels like he's contradicted himself, but I guess he can't keep doing
it. I don't think he's a contradiction in a sense, because, I mean, you know, what happened 2 years ago when we had COVID, which was a sort of, you know, an act of God almost, a one-off thing, where and the government then closed the economy down. It was a government decision to do that. You just can't do that without providing the sort of support that he did. I mean, I think there are arguments that he provided too much support, and as we've seen, there was quite a bit of fraud and so on. But you had to do something along those lines. Now, there's an interesting, if depressing, intellectual question you could ask: what would have happened if we hadn't, you know, if vaccines hadn't worked, and this had been a long-term thing? I mean, it doesn't bear thinking of, really. But you know, we and the rest of the world took a bet on this being something short term because vaccines would work, or, you know, in a slightly less positive world, you know, we would have ended up with herd immunity. But it was an act of God. It was hoped to be and was relatively short term. And the government put in place this extraordinary stay at home, stop working, had to support people. We've now got something which is a combination of almost the hangover from all of that, the supply chain problems, the inflation that came pre-Ukraine, and an energy price shock, which will make us worse off in the longer run, where this is much more of a traditional economic shock, where, you know, you literally can't just, I mean, it's actually quite hard to see how you could protect everyone forever from that kind of thing. Now, you can smooth that shock, and to some extent, again, that's what he's doing. Is there's a tax cut over the for some people at least over the coming year, and then it's and tax increases are gradually ratcheting up over the following years in order to help pay for some of that. But I think I think you identify one of the reasons exactly why it's so difficult for the Chancellor to explain why he isn't doing everything, because 2 years ago he did do everything. But, you know, we've never had a Chancellor who's been able to say, you know, look, here's a big economic shock and nobody's going to notice it. You just can't do that.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What does this week's statement tell us about his economic priorities?
Well, I think one of the, you know, he continues to say that he's a tax-cutting chancellor, and so his description of himself is all about relatively smooth state, cutting taxes and so on. I think, you know, a more honest description, if I had his economic instincts and it was doing what he was doing, I think I would put it more like this. I would say, I want to do everything I can to keep taxes as low as I can. I believe in a small a state which provides the health service and education and so on in the most efficient way possible, and an economy which allows me to keep taxes as low as possible. At the moment, because we're coming off a decade of austerity, because we've got huge pressures on the NHS, And because the economy is growing slowly, partly to do with COVID, partly to do with all sorts of other problems with our productivity, at the moment, in order to provide the services you all want, I have no choice but to have taxes going up over the next several years. I am the guy who will make sure they go up as little as they can whilst providing you with the services that you want. But I'm sorry, but I am raising taxes, and I'm doing it in this particular way. In the long run, I've set out in my lectures and so on a vision of how I want to get the economy growing faster. When that starts working, I hope to be able to start bringing that tax burden down. Now, I think that is a sort of an honest appraisal of what he's about. And I think he's sort of I think there's a problem for him in the difference between his communication of himself as a tax cutting chancellor with the, in my view, inevitable fact that he's actually going to be a tax increasing chancellor. The point is he should describe, and this is difficult communication, I'm the guy who will increase taxes as little as I can, is a much harder message than I'm a tax cutting guy.
It is, but people have seen the news, haven't they? They know that the last few years have been difficult. They're not divorced from that. Wedding those two things shouldn't be too difficult. But obviously he did dangle that carrot. He said, in 2 years' time, I will cut taxes. I mean, I remember the Gordon Brown budgets and the politics that laid at the heart of that, and how well targeted those messages were and how things were accounted for and everything. I can't ever remember a chancellor saying, here's my budget, but also right at the end, here's a trailer for the sequel.
Oh, we've had quite a lot of that, actually. I mean, there's quite a lot of... it's become more and more common over recent years to announce the pre-announced tax increases and pre-announced tax cuts. We'll take the basic rate down from 20p to 19p. In 2 years' time, is such an extraordinary sort of political moment in his spring statement speech. But the extraordinary thing is that at the same time, he's keeping the personal allowance, the point at which you start to pay income tax, fixed. And that's actually quite a big tax rise, because if you keep that fixed and prices and earnings are going up, then you're taking more income into the tax brackets. And at the moment, the forecast is that net, even in 2024, that won't be an income tax cut. He'll be cutting $6 billion worth with what he's doing to the rate of income tax, but adding $6 billion odd from freezing the personal allowance. So even then, it's not actually a year of an overall income tax cut.
On fuel duty, then, he cut it by 5p. Obviously, the cost of fuel has been soaring. How much of a difference would that make? Is that purely just a token move to say, I've cut a little bit, I've done something? I mean, will that have any meaningful effect on people's outgoings?
Well, it's fine. What effect will it have? It'll have effect of about 5p on a litre of fuel, which is, £2.50, £3 on a tank. It's one of these kind of small changes. It's better than a sort of kick in the head, but it's not going to change. It's not going to change the world, especially in the context of prices having gone up by whatever they've gone up by, 20 pence in the last month or two. I think that, the bigger worry for him is that he said very explicitly, this is a 1 year cut. Is he really going to put it up again next year? We haven't actually had an increase in fuel duty, even to keep up in line with inflation, for 13 years, which has actually been a huge tax cut since 2010, because fuel duty is a certain amount of pence per litre. Obviously, you keep the pence per litre fixed, then its value over time falls as prices rise. So that's been about an 8 billion tax cut over the last 12 years. He's added another, whatever it is, couple of billion to it this year. Would he really put it up again next year? He's going to be under the most immense pressure, not least from his own backbench MPs, not to do so.
I mean, this is what's difficult for chancellors, isn't it? It's about where you cut, where you save, but also where do you get that money in? and he's sort of he's cut off, you know, an area of always permanent demand for fuel that does bring money into the treasury.
Well, except actually one of his worries is that permanent demand for fuel is going to go. I mean, I can't remember, is it 15, 20% of new car sales are already electric? And of course, the government has said they want to stop the sale of all petrol and diesel cars by 2030. So that, you know, that's a big loss of revenue because petrol duty is quite big. It's getting on for 30 billion a year. So it's about something like the fifth biggest tax in terms of revenue. And he's going to need to make that up over the next couple of decades from somewhere. Now, that might be through road pricing or toll roads or finding some way of putting a tax on the electricity you put into your car or something. But again, that's a very tricky political thing to do.
Obviously, we're living in volatile times on the back of COVID, with inflation and now with war in Ukraine. What's the IFS view on the health of the public finances and how stable we can expect things to be in the medium term?
Well, in some sense,
are we going to be okay, I guess, is what I'm asking, Paul.
Well, you know, I mean, as I sometimes say, you know, we it's easy to get quite gloomy, but we are an awful lot better off than we were in the 1970s. On every, you know, we make these comparisons with the past. Average incomes now are, I don't know, twice what they were there then or more. We live 10 years longer. I mean, we live a lot longer than we used to. I mean, our health is far better. The stock of housing is far better. We pretty much all got central heating, which only a minority had back then. You know, we've got Zoom and iPhones and all these sorts of things. We can get too gloomy by looking at rates of change and not just remembering a little bit about how much better off we are than we used to be. A ray of sunlight in terms of the public finances. You know, in some senses, they've done astonishingly well. We had the biggest borrowing ever outside of the First and Second World Wars over the COVID pandemic. And on current projections, that borrowing is coming down very fast, such that within a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, Chancellor should probably only be borrowing to invest.
Wow.
which will be quite a remarkable turnaround. Now, you know, there's some fairly optimistic assumptions underlying that, so I suspect it won't go quite that well. But it's not, you know, the public finances are in reasonable shape in terms of borrowing.
Okay, so that's reassuring, because obviously, really, since the financial crash, the economy has not been in a great state. We had the crash, then austerity, and then just as it feels like you're coming out of that, COVID hits, and now we're getting this fueled inflation. There'll be people under the age of probably 30 that think, I've only ever lived in a time of economic strife. I've never really had one of those economic booms like I hear about from the 1990s. I mean, at what point do you think, are we out of the old economic cycle? I mean, I know that's a fool's question, but at what point do we get back to economics as usual?
That's a really good question. And it's I worry that I didn't enjoy my youth quite enough. you don't realise how good you've got it when you've got it. And, having, I suppose, from the sort of mid-80s through to 2008, you know, we had economic ups and downs, but basically, you know, incomes and earnings were rising pretty swiftly, you know, a reasonable rate every year. And we just got used to living standards growing by 1.5-2% every year. And the economy was growing. And as I say, I mean, there were ups and downs. But looking back at that, we've then had a completely different period since 2008, the biggest financial crash in, you know, pretty much 100 years in 2008, several years of falling real earnings after that, austerity literally on a scale never seen before in terms of government spending, economic growth, much more feeble than in over the period since 2008 than in the previous 50 years, earnings barely growing. In fact, I think we're in for the worst 15 years of earnings growth in history, literally. Productivity not growing, completely flat. Then we have, so we follow that up with the Brexit referendum, which is still expected to slow growth further. And then we have COVID, and then we have this crisis. It really does feel it is, you're right, a very different period to that which we had in, say, the 25 years before it. Much more difficult. And with very different sort of consequences for different sorts of people. I mean, again, there are groups who in the end have done extraordinarily well out of all of this, particularly those who had assets and housing wealth pre 2010. I mean, they've done really pretty well. And there's been a sort of long-term redistribution away from younger generations who have not had earnings growth, who are earning no more than their parents' generation, which again is historically unprecedented, and you know, can't save much because interest rates are zero, and can't buy houses because house prices are so high, and so on. So all of this has had big distributional effects, which again I think were pretty much were wholly unexpected at the time and very different from anything that we'd seen before.
One thing Labour called for was a windfall tax. You know, we know we liked this in 1997. Then it was on the privatised utilities to fund the New Deal. Now they're saying it would be on people like Amazon and Google who haven't paid their fair share. Why didn't Rishi Sunak fancy that, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think the windfall tax they were really talking about was actually on the energy producers. So, the of course, if you're getting gas and oil out of the ground, you've suddenly become incredibly rich because the price of gas and oil has gone through the roof through no sort of good work of your own. You suddenly started making vastly higher profits, and we've seen the profits of some of the energy companies, and they are huge. So the argument made is therefore they should be paying a higher rate of corporate tax on those profits. Now, the argument against a windfall tax is that we really ought to have a tax system which is stable and transparent, and where, before you make a profit, you know what tax you're going to pay on it. And if you start introducing windfall taxes willy-nilly, then people are going to stop investing and you have long-term damaging effects on the economy. And for sure, it would have been much better had we had in place a tax on... prior to this on energy producers, saying linking perhaps the rate of tax to energy prices or their profits, and that would have been a much better outcome. In my view, there is a case for a windfall tax at this moment on those producers. I think it's a better case actually than there ever was for a windfall tax on the privatized utilities. It's hard to imagine that putting as long as you're very clear around the parameters of this tax. If you say, so long as prices are above X, we'll levy a tax, a corporate tax, which is 10% higher on these specific groups. I can't really see that doing a great deal of damage in the long run. It could raise a reasonably significant amount of money in the short run. And help with some of the problems that we've been talking about. So, it's not a slam dunk. I think there are problems with windfall taxes. And in this case, there would no doubt be huge technical problems about saying precisely which profits and which organisations and so on will be affected. But I have to say, I think the case for it is probably stronger now on this particular sector than it's been for quite a long time.
I mean, it just feels sometimes when you're tinkering around with income tax brackets, you're avoiding other pots of money elsewhere. And I know there's no magic money tree, but there are certainly people doing far better, like energy companies, who are making huge amounts of money out of the present situation. And when you think about the cost of living and what it means for people who are out of work and on benefits, the difference between perhaps being forced to choose between heating and eating, it does feel as if, though, actually, for all the imperfect scenarios, getting people that have made a lot of money out of the present situation to just pay a little bit more. And I know it's a lot overall, but the pain is less than it is for someone living in the circumstances that many people in this country still do. Is it just that it's as simple as Rishi Sunak is a conservative and therefore that's never going to animate him in the same way that it would, say, Rachel Reeves if she was in number 11? Or do you think a Labour Chancellor still might make similar decisions to Rishi Sunak?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about Rishi Sunak and indeed his predecessors as Conservative Chancellors is they have really whacked up taxes on high earners. I mean, they really have. And I think this is something that hasn't been appreciated at all. But the tax on people on really high earnings, over 150,000, say, has gone up hugely since 2010. Something that I think is not generally appreciated. So these Conservative Chancellors are certainly taxing the rich a lot more than the Gordon Brown ever did. I mean, much more than Gordon Brown ever did. So there's a strange sort of, political juggling going on there. In terms of the sort of the windfall tax, I don't know enough to know how much it's not happening because the advice the Chancellor's getting is technically and administratively, we just couldn't do it, Chancellor. And to what extent it's not happening because he's taking a political view that it's the wrong thing to do. I don't know the answer to that.
Is there anything else in the spring statement that I haven't asked about that is interesting or that has caught your eye or, however small, is there anything that I've missed?
I mean, there are a few other things it's worth saying. I mean, one is the, one is something's in there and one is something isn't in there. So the thing that isn't in there is anything about public spending. So inflation has the same, just like households, the government buys stuff and it's getting more expensive. But public spending figures were set out in cash terms last October. And they're now that those cash that cash is now worth less. Worth less than it was, not worthless. and so the not only are households going to suffer the consequences of higher inflation, actually schools and the health service and so on are going to suffer the consequences of higher inflation because they're going to have to spend more with the same amount of money. And one of the big consequences of that will be, I think, more significant real pay cuts to public sector workers. And not least because my partner is an experienced teacher. The one example I continue to use is that experienced teachers have had really big pay cuts over the last decade. And the government has already put in evidence to the school teachers review body to suggest that they get only 3% this coming year with inflation at 8%. So you do that across the public sector, you're going to get some really big additional pay cuts. And the pay cuts in the public sector have been much bigger than in the private sector over the last decade. So that's one thing that wasn't there. He just simply didn't address that at all. One thing that was there was quite a lot of technical stuff about student loans and graduate repayments. Now, the policy was announced about a month ago, but this was the first time that it appeared in the in the budget arithmetic. And he's banking quite a lot of extra money from the changes to the way in which student loans are being repaid, where there are sort of three things going on. One is that, and this is something that people have been generally wanting, the interest rate that you need to pay is going down. Now, the curiosity there is that the only beneficiaries of that are actually high-earning graduates because most people never repaid, and so it didn't really matter what the interest rate was. They still repaid the same amount over their 30 years. Second thing, and this is the thing that will affect people immediately, is that the threshold above which you start to repay your student loan is being held fixed, and for new graduates is going down. So that's going to feel like a tax rise for a lot of recent graduates. And then there's the thing which is feels to me slightly like cloud cuckoo land, which is the decision to increase the repayment year term from 30 years to 40 years. Now, that feels like cloud cuckoo land because the idea that this would be stable in, we'll have the same system in 2060 as we do now, given that it's been changed about five times since it was introduced a decade ago, I think is probably a bit hopeless. But put all those together and actually, hey presto, in a couple of years' time, it looks like the chances of getting an extra 5 billion. Now, that's to do with kind of all sorts of bizarre accounting rules.
Cut to the chase. Recent graduates are going to feel like they've got a bit of a tax rise as a result of that as well.
I could do a whole episode on student finance.
Oh, you could. Well, let's do that.
Let's treat ourselves to the student finance special. Paul, it's always a pleasure having you on here. Thank you so much for being able to explain these things so clearly and succinctly and so quickly after the Chancellor's statement has been put out. I mean, it must be a hectic time once that document lands.
It is pretty hectic. I mean, the extraordinary thing is that I think this is probably the last time I'll talk about it because, you know, the public or the media interest sort of within 48 hours is gone and we moved on to the next thing. So you have to sort of get on top of it incredibly quickly, get the analysis out and then actually thankfully move on to something else.
Paul, thank you so much. You have many fans who listen to this show, follow your work and the work of the IFS, and you do a great job in explaining the public finances and holding the government to account. And we're very grateful.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Oh, man, what a guy. He should have his own TV show. He should be on every week explaining what's going on with the economy. I don't think we have really great economic education in this country in terms of like public service broadcasting. I mean, maybe I should just get him on every week. We'll do 5 minutes about the economy at the end of each episode. But I'm fascinated by economics and the political decisions and the economic decisions of chancellors. But also, what can the Bank of England do when inflation is global? You know, what are the options available to you? And our behaviour is changing all these things. And of course, just the dawn of electric cars is going to change our relationship with petrol and fuel tax and all stuff like that. So like, these things are coming. And being able to talk to someone who just understands it all so well and can communicate it all so well. I think, imagine if he'd gone into politics, what a phenomenal chancellor or shadow chancellor he'd be. Maybe that should be a qualification for being a Treasury minister, would be a period of time working at the IFS. But you can follow Paul on Twitter. I've put a link to his Twitter profile and all the phenomenal briefings that the IFS just puts out there for free. It's an amazing group, an amazing organisation, rather, that does play such an important role in educating the public about the reality of our public finances and the impact of them. It's fantastic. So obviously I always love recording these episodes, but when you get to pick the brains of someone who, I mean, my God, you know, that statement's been out just a few days and already he's on top of it. That's exactly what it means. What a remarkable public service that is for all of us. And now we are all fully briefed on what the spring statement means and what the coming years may hold. And while the coming weeks for me hold more touring and more live shows, as I say, both Edinburgh shows are now sold out, but there's about four or five tickets left for Glasgow. And then I'm going to Leicester and all sorts of other places. The political party, of course, returns on Monday, the 4th of April, with the fantastic James Cleverly. He's such a phenomenal guest. That'll be a really funny night. And then a week after that, the rescheduled Christmas special with Rosanna Annan Khan and Jacob Rees-Mogg. And then a week after that with Rosie Duffield and more guests to be announced. And future shows include Lisa Nandy, Gary Neville and David Davis. And, oh, yes, I'm bringing my tour show to London for a big show at the Bloomsbury Theatre on Saturday, the 23rd of April. So thank you for downloading this. Please do share it far and wide. Leave a review, leave a written review, and it helps get the podcast at the charts. And I'll see you soon. Have a great weekend. Ta-ra.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.